Hello. Good. All right, we're ready to go. Good morning, everybody. This is the October 5th, 2022 morning session of the Portland City Council. Good morning, Keelan. Please call the roll.
Good morning. Maps.
Here.
Rubio.
Commissioner Rubio, I didn't hear you.
Did you hear Commissioner Rubio?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Very lowly, very slow, very softly.
I'm so sorry. I only have.
There we go.
Oh, there you are.
You're fine.
Yeah, thanks so much. Ryan.
Here.
Hardesty.
Here.
Wheeler.
Here. So we'll now all hear from legal counsel on the rules of order and decorum. Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome to the Portland City Council. City Council is holding hybrid public meetings with limited in-person attendance in addition to electronic attendance. If you wish to testify before council in person or virtually, you must sign up in advance by visiting the council agenda on the council clerk's webpage at www.portland.gov/council/agenda. You may sign up for communications to briefly speak about any subject. You may also sign up for public testimony on resolutions, reports, or the first readings of ordinances. In-person testimony may occur from one of several locations, including City Council chambers in the Lovejoy Room in City Hall and the Portland Building. Written testimony may be submitted at cctestimony@portlandoregon.gov. Your testimony should address the matter being considered at the time. When testifying, please state your name for the record. Your address is not necessary. Please disclose if you are a lobbyist. If you are representing an organization, please identify it. For testifiers joining virtually, please unmute yourself over the once the council clerk calls your name. The presiding officer preserves order and decorum during city council meetings so everyone can feel welcome, comfortable, respected, and safe. The presiding officer determines the length of testimony. Individuals generally have 3 minutes to testify unless otherwise stated. A timer will indicate when your time is done. Disruptive conduct such as shouting, refusing to conclude your testimony when your time is up, or interrupting others' testimony or council deliberations will not be allowed. If there are disruptions, a warning will be given that further disruption may result in a person being ejected for the remainder of the meeting. After being ejected, a person who fails to leave the meeting is subject to arrest for trespass. Additionally, council may take a short recess and reconvene virtually.
Very good. Thank you. And colleagues, just a point of order. When we get to the regular agenda, we've had a request to move items 836 and 837 to the top of the regular agenda to accommodate Commissioner Rubio's schedule. So if I forget to do that, Commissioner Rubio, remind me at that time. First up is communications, item number 820. First individual, please.
Request of Fatima Magomedova to address council regarding Division Street safety.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. Fatima Magomedova here again, owner of Roman Russian Street, Roman Russian Food Store, talking about Division Street safety. As you might recall, on September 28th City Council meeting, Sarah Pearson, the owner of A1 Hot Pawn Shop, testified about the median obstruction to her business, reckless driving over median by irritated, frustrated, and angry drivers. If you recall, Commissioner Hardesty's response was, I quote, "We must change drivers' behavior in order to stop killing people on our streets with automobiles." I agree, we are changing in behavior, but in the wrong direction. It's changed for the worst. And here are an examples of that. Keelan, can we get an example number one? My first example involves TriMet handicap bus driving up a left turn out lane into wrong direction, taking a chance into head-on collision with oncoming traffic. I don't know if you can see the video or not. Oh, right there. Yes, if you can see, he's going into the opposite direction on oncoming traffic. If we can go to example number two, we're going to see, and I will wait. Yes, it says U-turns are so narrow that two vehicles try to make left turn at the same time. And they crashed into each other because larger vehicles cannot safely turn into the new narrow U-turns. Example number three. And here we have four drivers improvising, making U-turns through the wrong turn out packets. Then we have example number 4. And this is all, by the way, out from my window. Here is another confused driver. He is parking the front of our store facing oncoming traffic into the wrong direction. So now, as you can see, we got angry, impatient, irritated drivers who are losing their tempers driving over medians, taking shortcuts, and illegally turning left into wrong direction going against incoming traffic. This concern is so serious that the whole city is going into uproar over our street becoming so dysfunctional. It is clear to everybody that we have increasing crashes on Division Street more than ever. The owner of Washburn Car Wash, Dave Tarlow, who testified of the Sarah, he had the same bad experiences and concerns. It is time to reset. We need to research where mistakes we made, learn from them, and make necessary changes. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Next individual, please, item 821.
Request of Robert Butler to address council regarding Outer Division Project.
Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, underpaid, hardworking members of City Council of Portland, Oregon. My name is Robert Butler. I'm a native of Portland. So I have a federal report in front of me that's kind of propaganda as to what Vision Zero is about doing, and it's called access management. And the combined says, quoting, the combined purpose of the strategies of management access is to reduce crashes and traffic delay. Boy, would that be wonderful if we could have that on the division project. Anyway, we don't. So here's an example of a stop sign at 109th and Division. That's the Roman Russian Market. That's where there's a median now. Guess what we're missing? We have forgot to put up the no left turn sign. You have created a tragic situation that is so unsafe, it's incredible to send someone up the wrong way on a street there's no way out of. Shame on Portland. So getting on to the federal study, next thing that is talked about is the fact that there are problems with retailers as a result of this approach. And the feds recognize this, even though PBOT doesn't realize that businesses are going out of business are losing millions of dollars because of it. It is, quote, it is not uncommon for transportation agencies to compensate businesses for owners' losses. So going further down the report, sorry about the delay, talks about the fact that it is a requirement of all governmental agencies to involve the public in transportation policy and project decisions. Boy, I wish that would have happened. Said we had the secrecy of PBOT going underground, surprise attack on 30 blocks or 40 blocks of Division Street with this median. They didn't know about it until the construction crews showed up. So the median appears to be more about global warming and POing the public, discourage them from using their cars, closing the streets, creating road rage as a result, increasing traffic hazards. So we do need a reset before we go any further with fixing the mistakes. I already showed you one glaring mistake, and we need a reset. We need to refigure this out, and don't rush ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. Next individual, please, Keelan, item number 822.
Request of Heather Phipps to address council regarding blocked pedestrian public right-of-way.
Good morning, Heather.
I don't believe Heather has joined us.
All right, we'll move on to the next. Heather, are you out there? If you are, say so. Otherwise, we'll move on and see if she comes back later. Item number 823, next individual.
Request of Hazel R. Dennis to address council regarding fraud concerns and homelessness. They canceled their request.
All right, we'll move on to 824.
Request of Michael Brown to address council regarding reopening the Columbia Indoor Pool.
Michael, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, loud and clear. You sound good. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Mayor. And also City Council members Hardesty, Rubio, Mapes, and Ryan. I'm Michael Quincy Brown, and I have lived in North Portland my entire life. I know there is an effort underfoot to build an aquatic center in 5 to 7 years from now near the Jordan Center. The fact is, North Portland cannot go without an indoor pool for 5 to 7 years. This last summer, we had record number temperatures of 90 plus degrees. Because Columbia Pool was closed, it placed pressure on Peninsula and Pier Park pools, and they would reach capacity frequently. I would call in advance to take my grandchildren there when I was frequently told the pools were full to capacity. You can imagine these young kids turning away from the counter with tears because the pool was closed. I would then take my grandchildren to the river near Cathedral Park. A few days after our last visit, we were advised by the county and the media that there was toxic algae waste in the water there. That's in addition to whatever other hazards may be in the water. This is a time that our young people need an outlet. Columbia Park Pool provided that, year-round pool. My own granddaughter, Evie, learned how to swim in that pool, became a lifeguard, swim instructor, and swim coach. She had credit for 3 saves. Each lifeguard has their own story of life saving. We cannot determine how many lives have been saved since 1927 when this pool was built. By children learning to swim in this pool, it's so important, these life-saving skills. A brief story. Paul, a friend of mine, just celebrated his 101st birthday. World War II veteran, grew up in the community, learned how to swim in Columbia Park Pool. On October 26, 1944, the kamikaze plane had struck his ship. He was able to go overboard and save 3 sailors' lives by the skills he learned in that pool. Roosevelt High School swim team uses the Columbia Pool for swim meets and practice. The clear majority of Roosevelt students are people of color, and many come from low-income homes. The pool provided these young people with access to a year-round indoor pool. I've had contact with PTA groups, very receptive, neighborhood associations, Northwest Oregon Labor Council, several community members. Everyone is in favor of reopening the Columbia Park Pool as soon as possible. If one life is saved, it's well worth the investment in reopening the pool as soon as possible. I'm asking that this be done for our young people, our children, the seniors in the community that attend the life-saving or the exercise classes there. It's just so very important. So please do this for the community, the children. I also want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to address the City Council this morning.
Michael, thank you. And Commissioner Rubio, who's our Parks Commissioner, wants to make a comment. Commissioner Rubio.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor. And Michael, I just want to thank you for sharing your thoughts. And it's clear that you have a deep passion for this, and a lot of North Portland community members do as well. And there's a long, people have long personal histories with this pool. I just wanted to lift up that, as my council colleagues know, Columbia Pool is closed due to life safety issues. And with their support, we put aside $1.5 million for interim aquatic services for North Portland community. And that is being, getting ready to operationalize as we speak. So I just want to thank you for speaking what's true for you. And please don't hesitate to reach out to our office, or we can connect with you offline and give you an update about where you're at. Thanks.
Appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Hey, Michael, I also just wanted to jump in and say, I've been here about 6 years, and this is the first time we've actually had somebody come in and talk about lifeguarding and swimming and all that. Before I was in politics, I actually had an interesting life. I was a WSI, and I actually was part of my high school swim team, and we swam in that pool and had a lot of great events, and there's a lot of good memories there. And I just really appreciate you highlighting that this isn't just a facility, that this is actually a community gathering place, and it's also a place where people can learn life skills. And your illustration of the World War II veteran who used the skills he learned here in Portland, Oregon, in that very pool to save the lives of his fellow shipmates, that's an incredible thing to bring to the table here today. And I want to applaud you and thank you for that. We don't hear these topics very often, and I really enjoyed hearing your testimony. So thank you.
Thank you, Mayor.
Did 822 come back? Heather?
No.
Okay, very good. And that was 824. So I think, unless I flip my page, that completes public testimony, or did I miss somebody? No, that's it. Okay, very good. Consent agenda. Have any items been pulled? I understand 826 has been pulled.
That's correct.
Any others?
No.
Please call the roll on the remainder of the consent agenda.
Maps.
Aye.
Rubio.
Aye.
Ryan.
Aye.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Wheeler.
Aye. Consent agenda is adopted. To the regular agenda, can we please do item 836 first?
Amend trees code to improve clarity, efficiency, and outcomes of tree regulations.
This is a first reading of a non-emergency ordinance. Commissioner Rubio.
Thank you, Mayor. Urban trees provide important health and environmental services, such as reducing summer temperatures, improving air quality, managing stormwater, and improving public health outcomes. Title 11, the city's tree code, is an important tool in preserving our city's trees and expanding the services of the urban forest to all Portlanders. Proposed today are 35 technical and minor policy amendments to Title 11. These changes will improve clarity, resolve inconsistencies with other city titles, and provide tools for efficient implementation. The proposed amendments to Title 11 will result in better management of our urban forest infrastructure. Nick Desai and Brian Landau with Portland Parks and Recreation Urban Forestry are here today with a short presentation on the package of amendments, and City Forester Jen Cairo and Rick Faber, Permitting and Regulation Coordinator, are also available to answer any questions. So I will turn it over to them.
Good morning. Thank you, Commissioner Rubio. And good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Brian Landau. I'm with Urban Forestry. And thank you for this opportunity to present these proposed amendments to Title 11, Portland Street Code. Nick Desai and Rick Faber were instrumental in this work, and they're here today as well. We just have a brief presentation at this point. All right, Nick, you want to the next slide, please? So we have better research than ever on the necessity of trees in urban settings. Urban trees provide a multitude of established public health and environmental services. Urban trees improve air quality and reduce heat island effects. They sequester and store carbon, manage stormwater, provide habitat for wildlife and pollinators, and even have been shown to reduce crime, calm traffic, and improve pedestrian safety. And perhaps most significantly, trees have a biophysical effect on human health and well-being by reducing stress hormones, blood pressure, and just improving overall mental and physical health outcomes. Title 11 is the city's tree code, and it provides the regulatory framework for preserving and expanding Portland's urban forest. It was first adopted by City Council in 2011 and was implemented in 2015. Portland Parks and Recreation and the Bureau of Development Services are co-administrators of Title 11. Parks is responsible for all non-development aspects, which you can see on the right side of the table on the screen. While in development situations, Parks regulate city and street trees, while BDS is responsible for on-site trees. Just a little bit of background of how we got to this point right here. Over the course of the past 7 years or so, there have been a series of updates to the tree code brought before City Council. In 2020, in collaboration with Development Services and Planning and Sustainability, substantial updates to the development chapter of Title 11 were approved by City Council, and those primarily impacted tree preservation requirements. At that time, City Council also directed Parks, BDS, and BPS to develop a scope of work to further strengthen Title 11. And in May of 2021, Parks Urban Forestry presented a multi-phase project to both update the code, but also update Portland's Urban Forest Management Plan. And I'll go a little bit into that three-phased approach on the next slide. The first phase would involve making technical and minor policy changes to Title 11. And this was to address sort of known issues with the code, issues that have become apparent over the first 7 years of Title 11. This is the package that we are presenting today. Beyond that, in phase two, Parks will update Portland's Urban Forest Management Plan. So this is the guiding document for forest management for the city of Portland, and it has not been updated since 2004. Title 11 actually requires that it be updated every 10 years. This project is currently being scoped and will include a robust community engagement process to ensure that the new plan addresses the community priorities and vision for the urban forest. And finally, in phase three, Parks will work on a more substantive amendment package for Title 11. And that work will be informed by the community guidance and analysis that was completed during the Urban Forest Management Plan. From the outset, we established several goals for this project. They were to address these technical and minor policy updates using the existing staff resources that we had, improve overall management of the forest, improve the clarity and efficiency of the code. We really wanted to minimize impact to some of the other city bureaus that work with the code, and to minimize the impact to permit customers and just the regulatory process in general. And then finally, we were just committed to conducting early and continuous engagement with our bureau partners. Throughout this process, we regularly engaged with city bureaus on the proposed amendments and briefed the city's Urban Forestry Commission, Planning and Sustainability Commission, and the Development Review Advisory Committee. In May of 2022, the UFC and PSC held public hearings on the proposed amendments, and each has submitted statements of support. I also want to note that several changes to the amendments were made following those hearings, and we greatly appreciate the feedback we received from both the PSC and the UFC. Now with that, I'm gonna turn over to Nick, who's gonna talk a little bit more about the specific amendments being proposed.
Thank you, Brian. Good morning, Mayor. Good morning, commissioners. Today, we present to you a package of 35 proposed updates. With limited time on the agenda, we're not going to review all updates in this presentation, but instead share a few examples. And in addition to being in your council packets, the list of amendments and language changes for Title 11 have been publicly available online for the duration of this project. With the ultimate goal of improving management of our urban forests, the proposed updates fall into the categories listed here. Clarity, alignment with current practice, alignment with other city codes or policies, correcting errors, improving equity, and improving or avoiding negative outcomes. Our first example looks to incorporate language into the purpose section of Title 11, identifying trees as green infrastructure, consistent with the ordinance which established Title 11, which states that the intent of the tree code is to manage trees in the city as infrastructure. Additionally, this clarification aligns with language in Portland's Climate Emergency Declaration and other city policies. Item number 6 provides an example of alignment with current practice. Currently, when a permit decision is issued and the applicant files an appeal, the city forester conducts an internal administrative review prior to the appeals board hearing. This occasionally results in the applicant either withdrawing their appeal or the initial permit decision being overturned by the city forester. The applicant still has the option to appeal the decision, but this step serves as a qualitative check on the decision, potentially saving time and money. And the language proposed is similar to existing language in other city codes. Our third example is pretty straightforward. Titles 11 and 33 previously defined multi-dwelling residential as greater than two units. Updates to Title 33 now define multi-dwelling residential as more than four dwelling units on a single lot or parcel. And this change merely brings Title 11 into agreement with Title 33 and does not affect any permitting decisions. Item number 41 addresses equity. The Urban Forestry Commission consists of 11 community members appointed by the mayor to advise on urban forest management. As volunteers, they commit to monthly meetings, which can last 2 to 3 hours plus preparation time. Additionally, they serve on subcommittees. Allowing the possibility of compensation opens the opportunity to serve on the UFC to a more broad demographic. And finally, our last example is in the avoiding negative impacts.
One moment, please. Commissioner Hardesty has a question on that.
Thank you, Mayor. Could you go back one slide, please? Removing the without compensation clause, I believe, sets expectation that volunteers are going to get some kind of remuneration around their service. What's your plan on that? Are you just removing the language? What happens once you remove the language? And who pays for that?
I'm going to, Jen Cairo can explain, provide some explanation on that. She's here.
Good morning, Commissioner Hardesty and Commissioners and Mayor. Thanks for the question, Commissioner Hardesty. So parks and the Civic Life Office are working on guidance, policy guidance around what situations compensation might be provided. And the intention here is rather than making this expected and pro forma, it's a tool with which we can help folks participate in these advisory groups who have income as a barrier. So it's not the intention for it to be an expectation, and that's the way it'll be communicated with applicants and commissioners.
I appreciate that response, Jen, but I want to caution you that we are looking at a policy for citywide, and I get concerned that we set expectations for some volunteers at the beginning that they'll get a stipend, and then others expect a volunteer forever.
Sorry about that. My mic was not working. Where was I? I was just saying I'm concerned about setting an expectation that the city cannot meet. We should have one standard for who qualifies for a stipend, and we should not be changing policy without a plan about how we make that happen. So we have several committees that for some reason got stipends, but there's not a city policy at the moment. And I would just caution us to not keep piecemealing this very important role, because again, we want people to continue to volunteer to provide their expertise to the city. And we're setting up a very inequitable system when you just decide that you're just gonna take the language out with nothing else. Thank you. Please continue.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner Hardesty. Our last example is in the avoiding negative impacts category. When a non-development request for tree removal is received, code does not currently provide enough flexibility to assess when tree removal may negatively impact the health and safety of the trees that are remaining. In some cases, removing a tree can make other trees considerably more vulnerable to new edge effects such as windthrow, sunscald, and unbalanced canopy. This amendment adds consideration of impact to other trees with proposed tree removal with the objective of minimizing any of these impacts to the health and safety of the public and the remaining trees. With these examples provided to demonstrate the scope of our project, we thank you for your consideration and are happy to field any questions that you may have at this time.
Commissioner Hardesty.
First, I just want to thank the Parks Bureau and the forestry, the Urban Forestry Department for their very deep work. I understand you spent some quality time with my policy analyst, Derek Bradley, around answering some questions. And so some of those questions I want to put on the record. So on page 55, your general tree preservation, it says basically that that you would now, rather than mandating consulting, now the urban forestry would be the mandatory approval of projects. That terrifies me. Why are we going from you actually advising to you actually being the approval place? Anybody?
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner Hardesty. Rick Faber is here today. He's our permitting regulation coordinator. So I'll let him answer as well, because he's one that works specifically on these regulations. But I will say that the intent of that, we spoke with the staff of BPS who originally drafted Title 11, and the intent with that original language was to really get urban forestry at the table with these CIP projects. Which was had not been the case prior to Title 11, which is where that consulting language came from. But elsewhere in code, it really establishes the city forester as the regulator of city and regulator of city and street trees. And so this is really just sort of clarifying that work on city and street trees does require a permit sign off by the city forester. So that's really where that's coming from. But I think Rick might be able to give a little more specifics on that.
Hi, this is Rick Faber here, permitting and regulation coordinator. Thank you for the time, Mayor and Commissioners. It's a great question, Commissioner Hardesty. Just to bounce off what Brian is saying, the urban forestry isn't going to be given the sign-off for projects. This is simply clarifying that urban forestry is responsible for reviewing the urban forestry components of Title 11 within these projects.
But if you tell me that you have mandatory approval of projects, and let me just say I have not found urban forestry to be really easy to work with, but all of a sudden, if you are the one that gets to sign off, I find that there's a big difference in my mind between being required to consult with you and then giving you a total authority to sign off on projects. So if I'm misreading this or misinterpreting this, then what part am I getting wrong?
I think the misunderstanding here is that urban forestry is not receiving the total authority to do anything here. Urban forestry is acting the part of the reviewer for the trees within the public right-of-way. This is similar to Portland Water Bureau being responsible for the water pipes and BES being responsible for the sewers. This is urban forestry being responsible for the trees.
Well, let me just say words have power. And if you tell me that I'm required to consult with you to make sure that I am using the appropriate procedures, then that tells me one thing. If you tell me that my project does not move forward unless you okay it, that tells me a whole different set of things. So my question remains, what are you attempting to get at with this change?
The attempt is clarity, again. The clarity that urban forestry is going to review Title 11 to make sure that the Title 11 requirements are met.
Shouldn't it just say that?
Well, it says that elsewhere. That's what this is getting at, is that elsewhere in the code, it already refers to the responsibility of the urban forester or the city forester for these requirements. The consultation was confusing to many applicants, and the intent here is to remove that confusion.
I'm still not satisfied with that answer, but I'll ask my next question. My next question is on page 58. It's mandating urban forestry approval for all future sidewalks that may be built using PBOT's new pedestrian design guideline. So my question is, how does this help us install or hurt us installing sidewalks? especially in areas of the city who aren't privileged to have sidewalks at the moment.
It was page 58, you said?
Page 58. It says urban forestries would have approval for all future sidewalks. What, again, I'm just trying to understand the difference between the minor administrative changes and what this means as far as policy.
Are you referring to the street tree planting standards B, activity that is limited to the street, does not modify or create sidewalks, tree wells, or existing potential tree planting areas? I'm afraid I'm not quite sure which section we're looking at here.
So are you on page 58 of your document?
I am on page 58.
All right. Let me pull up your document again. I'm just looking at my I'll go to my next question since you don't know where that question is. The next one is on page 85. It seems that there is a large expansion of the authority of the urban forestry to stop any public works program. So again, you're telling us that this is just administrative changes that we're making, and it looks like we're continuing to broaden the authority of the urban forestry team. Am I reading this incorrectly?
Are you referring to the stop work orders when any work is being conducted in violation of this title? Yes. So the striking of the end public health or safety is threatened is bringing this code in alignment with every other city code that has a stop work order. This stop work order qualification of end public health or safety is threatened is unique to the current version of Title 11 and is not found anywhere else in Title 11. So the removal of this is intended primarily for non-development situations when somebody is conducting permitted tree work or regulated tree work without a permit. It gives another tool in the toolbox for the city forester to go and instruct them to stop the unpermitted tree work before they've caused irreparable harm.
Okay, that was very helpful. Thank you, Rich, for that. Thank you.
Mr. Maps.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I want to thank Commissioner Rubio and staff for these items and today's presentation. I just have a quick question, I think, for Nick. Nick, I believe your presentation today basically summarized 35 amendments. I was also, frankly, looking at Exhibit B, which I think lists 47 amendments. And I was just wondering where the difference came from. Are you kind of putting a couple of buckets into the same amendment, or did we have 12 amendments that sort of dropped off between whenever Exhibit B was put together and today's ask?
Thanks for your question, Commissioner Maps. We do have 35 items. They are numbered according to our original. We originally had a larger set and we had pared that down through the revision process, and after meeting with bureau partners and stakeholders and receiving input, we ended up bringing it down to the list of 35. So those are referring to the original item numbers. We just wanted to keep consistency through our process.
Okay, so just so I'm clear, some of the items listed in Exhibit B have dropped out of the ordinance, is that right?
The items in Exhibit B reflect all 35 line items that are in the package.
Yep.
The original draft had items that are not in this document, Exhibit B.
Okay, it would be great if maybe someone from your staff could talk to someone from my staff to clarify the ones that have dropped out, I think.
Okay.
Great, thanks.
Commissioner Ryan.
First of all, thank you, Commissioner Rubio, Jen Cairo, and the team of Brian, Nick, and Rick. Okay, that was fun to say. My first question is a level setting one. It's at the very beginning when you had the quadrant, and it shows where, in fact, BDS has authority and where the Parks Bureau has authority. Most of it makes sense to me intuitively, except one square. And I just want you to explain it to me on why. And that would be the non-development private trees. How did that land where the authority would be with parks? I'm not saying it's a bad decision. I just would love to understand.
Yeah, I would say that really came from, I think, a little bit of how we were discussing the purpose of Title 11, which was to elevate the role of the City Forester and bring regulations that were spread across several different titles into a single cohesive tree code. And it was intended to elevate the role of the City Forester as really the manager of the urban forest, and with a significant portion of our canopy on private property. That was really the intention of bringing that within the sort of like cohesive management of the urban forest. And then with the one exception being that Bureau of Development Services being responsible for on-site development activity.
Yeah, so when there's construction activity, it's BDS.
Yeah.
When someone's lived in a home for 40 years and they suddenly have a tree situation, then it's parks.
Yeah.
Okay. Absolutely. And I really did ask because, you know, we are people that live around neighbors and they ask us questions. And so I don't think I gave a very good answer when that came up recently. So thank you for that.
And if I can just jump in, sorry,
sure.
One more moment. Title 11 does have that as the current standard, but prior to Title 11 was the tree cutting ordinance. I believe it was implemented sometime in the 90s or 80s, which also had the city forester with authority over certain on-site private tree property permits.
And especially that's true with the heritage trees, yes?
Right.
Yeah, which I think everyone could be supportive of. You all were here, I think it was last May, it was May 2021, and I recall that meeting, and you were engaging with stakeholders on these necessary proposed amendments. When I was listening to your presentation, I was trying to really get a sense of what that engagement was like. Can you give me a couple stories and maybe amplify that a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So part of the intention with this amendment, we did try to keep the scope fairly narrow and to really work on issues that have been identified over the first few years of Title 11. We also were informed by some evaluations of the code that had taken place. A few years after Title 11, the city auditor's report conducted an analysis and proposed some recommended changes. Some of those are in this package as well. And then in terms of the actual engagement, it was really working with the city's Urban Forestry Commission, the Planning Sustainability Commission, and the Development Review Advisory Committee. We have intended really to do the bulk of the community engagement and seeking community guidance through the Urban Forest Management Plan and the subsequent amendments that come then. So, this was a project that was intended to be public and transparent and engage through those community advisory groups, but also we plan to do much more robust community engagement through the upcoming work.
That makes sense. And it's always good to hear what other bureaus you were coordinating with. I think sometimes it's when you sit up here, it's always difficult to track that. The pilot for financial assistance to low-income households, how's that proceeding? I know that this can be quite a burden. And this, again, is hearing from elders on fixed incomes when they suddenly, it happens fast, which is great that we live in a city that still has trees that get big. But suddenly there's this big burden for that person. And I know we've talked about the $100 removal of perhaps the permit. And does it go any further than that? Because then you have to hire the arborist, a professional, to do the work. And it's a shock. It's a sticker shock to people. Tell me about the dialogue around that.
Yeah, absolutely. We did conduct a pilot project, and I'll actually let Rick led that pilot project, so I'll let him speak a little bit to it.
Thank you. Commissioner Ryan, you did hit the nail on the head that the current financial assistance program is very limited in scope. It is geared primarily towards the fee waivers, and it does not provide assistance to actually doing the tree work. I actually have all the data in front of me, and I am working on putting together a report to kind of summarize all of those findings and to make proposals for how we can expand or modify so we can better provide assistance to those in need.
Okay, Rick, that's helpful. And I know Commissioner Rubio and I could talk further about that and hear about how we can go further with that. Well, one, to look at the findings and see what you've discovered and then make some appropriate decisions going forward. I will just say that in the few conversations I've had on this, it's troublesome for people because of course they want to do the right thing. And the sticker shock of that really is stressful for them in terms of managing their finances. So I think we all have empathy for that. I see head nodding. Okay.
Yes.
And then when you look at the first phase of these minor technical fixes to Title 11, do you think we're on track to get to phase two and then phase three?
Yeah,
I think I'm thinking back to the May meeting, and sometimes I've been here now 2 years, and I'm trying to make sure that I notice the process has evolved from last May. And I know it has, but it makes me ask questions like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I can speak a little bit to that. So one of the things that we in that May presentation, we noted that we would be doing this existing current project with the sort of staff resources that we had. I'm really pleased that we've been able to bring on a dedicated policy planning and policy analyst that has joined Urban Forestry almost two months ago. And they are working on the Urban Forest Management Plan. So we are actually scoping that plan right now. We are working on some RFPs to bring a lead consultant and a lead community engagement consultant online in early 2023. So really pleased that work is progressing. Updating the Urban Forest Management Plan is long overdue. The current plan is silent on things like climate change and environmental justice. We know there's a lot of improvements that can be made. So really happy to see that work going.
Thank you all for answering my questions. It was a great conversation. I appreciate it.
Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. Brian, your last statement actually poked another question in me. So we know that some parts of Portland have beautiful tree canopy. Some parts don't have any trees at all, or barely no trees. How is your planning going to change that? How is what we're doing today actually going to have any impact on that at all?
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner Hardesty. I would say these amendments. I don't want to oversell them. They are not making substantive impacts to that. I think they are. These are really minor fixes, and I wouldn't say they really get at some of these underlying historical issues that have resulted in the canopy inequity that we have today. Urban Forestry is really committed to working on that. Our tree planting program is focused on planting in these underserved areas. But I wouldn't want to portray these amendments as making substantial gains on that. That is absolutely the goal with updating the Urban Forest Management Plan, and it's absolutely the goal of the subsequent amendment work we would like to do. But this was a fairly narrow work.
So what I hear you saying is I can expect to see more in the second round and the third round after you've completed all this community engagement process. I'll be looking forward to that. And let me also say that equity, you only used the word equity once in your document, and it was all around whether people get paid for volunteering their time. I would challenge you to actually incorporate equity throughout your entire document, because if we were looking at tree canopy from an equity standpoint, I think we would have different priorities. So I'm disappointed to see that the only place you identified equity as an issue is around whether people are compensated or not. I think there are a lot more equity issues when it comes to tree canopy than just that. Thank you.
Is there any public testimony on this item?
We have three people signed up.
All right, 3 minutes each. Name for the record, please.
First up, we have Betsy Reese.
Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. You You all have had a lot on your plates, but sometimes we're so busy keeping our noses to the grindstone that we forget to lift our chins and look up. In the case of our urban tree canopy, that is both metaphorical and literal. Please add tree smothering vines to the tree code. Those words could fit right here on the tree code. Our tree code specifically prohibits inflicting injury on a tree, including trenching, excavating, altering the grade, smothering the roots, bruising, scarring, tearing, or breaking of root, spark, trunk, branches, or foliage, using herbicides or poisoning, felling, cutting, or removing any portion of the crown, trunk, or root system of a tree, girdling, poisoning, topping, drowning. It requires controlling insect infestations and tree diseases. I can only think that the omission of those two words has been inadvertent. Clematis vitalba is rapidly blanketing and smothering trees to death in Portland. In other jurisdictions around the country and around the world, its abatement is being taken dead seriously. This photo was taken in February of a 60-foot tall western red cedar. Already more than half of its branches are dead from this vine. This is the same tree, picture taken in July. It is completely covered with the vine, as are the adjacent trees, with the vine leafed out. And this is the same tree, already gone to seed in August and blowing its seeds all over the neighborhood. Urban forestry now can only wait until it's too late to save this tree and then order the dead or dying tree to be cut down when it poses a hazard to life or property. I would like to ask you today to please either one, vote to add these two words to the tree code, or two, address this request now directly and publicly with a logical and official explanation of why tree smothering vines will not be added, or three, postpone voting on the amended tree code today until this issue can be further studied. Thank you, everyone, for hearing my testimony.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Next individual, please, Keelan.
Next up, we have Edith Gillis.
Hi, Edith.
Edith, you're muted.
Can you hear me?
Edith, do you have two? Okay, try again. Go ahead, Edith.
I would like you to be concerned that it doesn't allow you to properly fine those who endanger our trees. And when you say that if there's a delay in planting, that there is only the cost of the labor and the tree, when actually trees not being here, not being healthy, not being equitably distributed, cost human lives, and human lives are worth far more than minimum wage digging a shovel. And I think we also need to be much more careful that the same size, type, and age of a tree each year will less and less be able to provide the services that we need due to the increased air pollution. Even if we never again burned any fossil fuels or did any fracking or anything like that, we have all these feedback loops already in place. And so there's going to be increased heat. So the tree's stoma and their leaves are going to tighten shut. As there's more air pollution, as there's more drought, it won't open up to take in the carbon from the air and the pollution from the air and put it down to the soil. The roots will be weaker. They won't have the strength to suck up as much water. The water table will go down. There's more pollution in our water table in Portland, poisoning the trees. And then we've got, of course, the tear gas and everything. So then the tree cells won't have the strength and the structure for the xylem to suck or pull or vacuum the water up from the roots. So it won't do the transevaporation, allowing humidity out, and it won't release the healthy aerosols that are necessary to seed the clouds, to have the rain that we need for our economy, our safety, and our health. So we must put much greater value on trees because it's a matter of life and death in our economy. And we need to have more and more and more and more trees. And instead of removing trees that are sick, because all of our trees are going to be sick, we need to find better ways to support them. Yes, get rid of those contagious parasites or diseases, but provide the health and the safety so the trees are not susceptible to parasites and diseases, and they can better withstand it, because that is what we need to have the water that we need to function. That's what we need to have lives. That's what we need to have people living in Portland able to pay tax dollars.
Thanks, Edith. Next individual, please.
Next up, we have Yiwan Chong.
Welcome.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yep, yes. Loud and clear.
Great. Good morning, commissioners and mayor. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. I'm Yiwan, and I reside in the King neighborhood of Northeast Portland and have lived here for 14 years with my chosen family of four adults and one child. We are a multiracial and queer family. Brooks Nelson and Jeannie LaFrance own this property but cannot be here today due to their jobs. As a family, we decided to take advantage of the residential infill project to make me a homeowner too by building a second ADU. We need to remove an apple tree to make enough room for my new home. But we learned through the design and permitting process that we have to pay $13,000 because of the tree code. The lifespan of apple trees is 50 to 80 years old. But this apple tree is as old as the main house, over 100 years old. And this tree is still alive today because we understand the importance of tree canopy for our neighborhood. Over the last two decades, we have invested thousands of dollars in caring for this tree. So imagine our shock when we learn that this $13,000 to the tree fund while trying to take advantage of RIP. This apple tree is at the end of its life. If we move forward with the second ADU, we plan to grow two new trees, which actually sustain a longer-term healthy canopy. So it is actually really hard to see this $13,000 not as a punishment. It is short-sighted. This $13,000 fine increases the cost of building this ADU by about 5%. It is significant for this project and for a family with modest means. This tree code, has become a barrier to create density and the badly needed affordability in our city. So I am testifying to highlight how badly needed the coordination and alignment so that the tree code does not actually counter other goals of affordability and density and also equity. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Hardesty has a comment.
And thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Yiwan. It's so wonderful to see you testifying here at Portland City Council. It's been a long time since we've thank interacted. You. I really appreciate the very colorful display that you showed the difference between the values that develop our policy around tree canopy and you as someone who is a wannabe homeowner, what your experience is in attempting to take advantage of the residential infill property. I think that was a perfect example of the values around the policy not being consistent across the board. So I really appreciate you pointing that out. And it makes me ask, in a situation like this, what would the Forestry Bureau say to them? What would you say to someone who is experiencing this huge cost increase? What would your response be, Brian or Nick or somebody?
Thank you, Commissioner Harvey, and thank you for the public comment. Yeah, I think we understand that there is there can be tension at times between increasing density and preserving trees. The code is, it sounds like based on that fee that you probably have about a 28-inch deep DBH tree, which is a large tree. And right now the code does try to de-incentivize removing large trees in development situations. So. I definitely sympathize with the situation that you're in, and yeah, I don't know, maybe Rick or City Force or Cairo have anything to add on that.
So I'll add the code perspective. That cost is due to what's called the 20-inch rule as part of the tree preservation requirement. That is outside the scope of what we're trying to accomplish with these current technical and minor amendments. That specific rule actually does have a sunset date of December 31st, 2024. So it will be back in front of council for a full review or before that time.
Again, my goal is not trying to put you in a spot right now, but I do think this is a perfect example of, I would imagine none of us intended that we would be a barrier against adding housing, especially when you describe the tree as being over 100 years old, and it's 75 years over its normal lifespan. So again, I'm just trying to figure out as a community member, right, how do people maneuver these policies when what they're trying to do is add to the housing stock, right? So, but I think this was a perfect example of a policy not actually living up to. So what do you do when someone's in this situation? And I see other hands are up, so I'll stop. See, Commissioner Rubio may want to weigh in.
Commissioner Rubio, then Commissioner Ryan.
I just wanted to make some space for Jen. Jen, could you please engage and give us a vision of what we're trying to do here overall and how we're trying to get these things into alignment so we're not in conflict with one another? Thanks, Jen.
Certainly, Commissioner Rubio, and thank you, Commissioner Hardesty, for following up on the public comment. There is an inherent tension with regulations on private properties and other properties, and trying to implement the city's goals, whether it's in communal goals, whether it's in regards to trees or stormwater management or water supply or public rights of way. And that's what we're seeing here. And the tree code currently does have requirements, as Rick and Brian explained, trying to retain the tree canopy we have in the city, which is difficult, if not impossible in many cases, to replace. And the tool that is used right now, or there are a few tools, but one of the main tools is in a development situation like this resident is talking about, a certain amount of payment to partially mitigate for the services of the tree that's lost. And that's what the code presents to us today. You heard earlier today from, I believe it was Brian in the presentation, that this package that's before City Council right now is phase one of a three-phase plan, the next phase being updating Portland's Urban Forest Management Plan, and the third phase being more comprehensive amendments to the tree code. And both of those, the Forest Management Plan and the third phase, the more substantive amendments, those will be opportunities to get more exploration into the tension that exists between wanting to have canopy in the city and wanting to have infill development. In many ways, it comes down to design, and also it's about condition of trees. So when we hear about a tree that's 100 years old and has outlived by 75 years, it's really dependent on the species and where they're located, and that's carefully considered on site by the staff involved in doing it, and decisions are made case by case. So if a tree really isn't worth keeping, so to speak, because it's declining, then they wouldn't be required to pay that type of mitigation fee if it were a dead tree or something like that. I hope that's helpful.
Yes, Jen, thank you. That was very helpful to me. I hope it was helpful to I see Ying Wong's hand is up again. Did that help you?
So just to make sure that I said the years correctly, so The apple tree lifespan is usually 50 to 80 years old, and this is over 100 year old tree. As far as we know, there isn't an appeal process. I've asked many of my architect and other folks that there is no existing process. The tree is not dying because we have done such a good job at taking care of it. It's just that it's an apple tree. I totally understand if it's a different type of tree. You know, if it's a cedar tree, a duck fruit tree, this is an apple tree. And so we have done such a good job that it is not dying. It's not a heritage tree. And we were told there is no appeal process.
So I'm going to thank you. I'm going to keep us moving if we could. We're still on our first agenda item. Commissioner Ryan.
Yeah, I do want to just weigh in. Thank you so much for your testimony, Yi Wong Chong. I have had the pleasure of being involved with the improvements to our permitting process. And so your story comes up over and over again. And so I'm really grateful that you're here today. There's always nuance in how we look at codes. And sometimes it's difficult in real life when we're implementing them to have such sensible conversations. So I think what your answer, Jen Cairo, got to some of it, but I wasn't hearing, it seems like we put a lot of emphasis on the size of the tree, but we don't factor in the life cycle, the expected life of the tree in the code. And so I think it seems like, have you considered that dialogue and how that could be implemented? So then the testimony we hear today would be mitigated with much more efficiency.
Thanks, Commissioner Ryan. We certainly can and are continuing to collect input and observations for future proposed amendments to the code. So we'll take that into account. I wanted to speak to the average lifespans of trees. So if we look up a tree species online, we'll find an average lifespan. That varies widely by the conditions the tree is in. Could be much shorter, it could be much longer. And it also, we're talking about climate differences as well as site-specific differences. So an apple tree growing in South Carolina would have a different projection than would a tree growing in the Pacific, an apple tree growing in the Pacific Northwest. Same with other species and soils, hydrology on the site. You know, they're living things. And so there is wide variety from what standards one might find or frameworks one might find published. So in our work, culture and urban forestry, you're really looking at that tree in its situation and its health and condition at that time, rather than only looking at what expectations might be.
So I'm just going to jump in with a comment, not a question, because I do want to keep us going. Jen, you know, it was mentioned that, I mean, first of all, let's acknowledge we're in a housing emergency. And so infill, and we went through great pains to pass the residential infill program and Central City by Design, acknowledging that. And I just want to make sure we're being pragmatic. I can't get into Yi Wong Chong's specific case because I don't know all the facts, but what I heard him say on the record was he wants to do more residential infill per the code change process we went through, and he's willing to replace the tree with two trees. And I just want to make sure we're being pragmatic in our approach to balancing development and our desire to maintain a tree canopy. It seems to me that what he proposed just struck me as a common sense compromise to get us there, and I don't know why that's not being accepted as an acceptable route, and I don't need to know today, but at some point I'd love somebody to shoot me an email and explain it to me. That completes public testimony, does it not?
It does.
All right, this is a first reading of a non-emergency ordinance. It moves to second reading. Thank you, everybody. Next item, please, also a Parks Bureau item 837, please.
Authorize competitive solicitation and contract with the lowest responsible bidder for construction of the Washington Park South Entry project for an estimated cost of $5,200,000.
And if I could find it, here it is. This is a second reading. We've already heard a presentation, which was fantastic, and taken public testimony on this item. Is there any further business? Seeing none, please call the roll.
Maps.
Aye.
Rubio.
I just want to again thank Travis Roybal for his presentation and the excellent work here. I vote aye.
Ryan.
Aye.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Wheeler.
I am very excited about this project. This is one that's been thought about for many, many years, and it will create a new access point and a more logical way into the park from the north. And I just appreciate everybody who's worked so hard on this, including you, Commissioner Rubio, and your team. I very happily vote aye. The ordinance is adopted. Back to the beginning of the regular agenda in order. Item number 830, please.
Appoint and reappoint members to the Rental Services Commission for terms to expire October 5th, 2024.
And let's see. I don't have any information on that. Oh, Commissioner Ryan, I'm sorry. I was looking at the wrong one. So why
Thank
am I
you,
doing
Mayor Wheeler.
This? Commissioner Ryan.
Yes, I heard you. It's good. I'm really excited to present a series of appointments to the Rental Services Commission. These there are three vacancies, and our appointments bring invaluable perspective, experiences, and insight to the conversations around rental housing and policy. We have Stephanie Bridges, a policy analyst with Urban League, Angeletta Morello, a policy advocate with Hunger Free Oregon, and we have Amber Cook, who brings incredible insight as a court observer with PSU's Housing Crisis Research Collaborative. I've had the pleasure of meeting with a couple of the folks here, and they've been great conversations. I'm going to turn this over to Deputy Director Matthew Schaubold for additional remarks, and also thank him for stewarding this group. Take it away, Matt.
Thank you, Commissioner. And for the record, Matthew Schaubold at the Portland Housing Bureau. Just briefly, the Rental Services Commission is one of the Bureau's five permanent advisory bodies and the city's primary advisory body for discussing landlord, tenant, and fair housing work. They also work with our Fair Housing Advocacy Committee. That is our multi-jurisdictional group that does our fair housing analysis and planning. So we're very pleased. We always appreciate people who volunteer their time to advise the city and discuss issues that are relevant to all Portlanders. And so this is a series of appointments and reappointments. And I would just say that all three of our new appointees are here today at council to share some remarks about themselves if they would like. I believe we have one in the chamber and two on the Zoom. So please take it away, Stephanie, Angeletta, and Amber.
Angeletta, if you want to come down to the table.
Morning.
Good morning. It's weird being on this side of things.
It is. It's weird seeing you.
Yeah, hello. I wasn't told that I was supposed to share remarks, so I don't really know what to share. My name is Angeletta, or Angelita Morillo. I am a policy advocate at Hunger Free Oregon, and I grew up in Portland. And I have dealt with a lot of housing issues in Portland as a renter and as the daughter of a single immigrant mother. When I was in high school, my family was illegally removed from an apartment building. And years later, we found out that they specifically raised the rent for Latino families and made it impossible for my single mother to keep us housed. So that was a very formative experience for me. And I think years later, seeing how important knowing our renters' rights are and making sure that our housing policy keeps people housed in a time where we have lost so many people who are now living on the streets, living in trailers, knowing how important it is to ensure that these housing policies are really looked at with a fine-tooth comb and that the public knows the different issues that are happening so that they can advocate for themselves is something that I have always been very passionate about, and I hope to bring that to this work.
Thank you, Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. I just wanted to, since we have Angeletta in the council chambers, just really appreciate her for the 3.5 years she gave to my office as our constituent relations person. She will bring that same passion that she brought to the position in my office to this, to the Rental Services Commission, I have no doubt.
And I am just so thrilled that you haven't been like running screaming from the city of Portland that you don't want any part of it anymore. I'm so thrilled to see you stepping into this role. You will bring a lot of great knowledge, both that you've learned from your lived experience and what you've learned as a staffer in my office. So thank you for your willingness to serve. I'm amazed that people still want to volunteer at the city of Portland. So I thank you for that.
Thank you, Commissioner Hardesty.
Angelita, I just wanted to say thanks for being here. And you told us you didn't realize you were going to say something. But what you said was exactly what we needed to hear. So thanks for sharing your life experience. Those are the stories that bring us closer to the word. Thanks for being here. And thanks for your service.
Thank you.
And then if Amber would like to share any remarks or Stephanie, feel free, but otherwise we're good to take the vote, Mayor.
I mean, I was just gonna say, thank you for the appointment. I look forward to serving my term. I am a low-income renter who's been a housing advocate and tenant organizer for the last 3 or 4 years, and have become, slowly more and more involved with the political side of things, and have given testimony at the Rental Services Commission for a number of years, and look forward to being part of it on a different level. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll entertain a motion to accept the report.
So moved.
Commissioner Hardesty moves.
Second.
Commissioner Ryan seconds. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Maps.
I want to thank Angelita, Amber, and Stephanie for agreeing to serve on this important committee. I vote aye.
Rubio. Oh. Ryan.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, all three of you, for your time. It's what we need, and we need your perspective at the table. And I'm excited to vote aye.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Wheeler.
Aye. The report is accepted. The appointments are approved. Thank you for your service. Next item, please. Item 831, a second reading.
Authorize a letter of agreement between the City and the Portland Police Association to implement a police dispatch trainee certification pilot project by increasing the pace of certification for emergency communications dispatchers.
Colleagues, any further discussion on this item? Seeing none, please call the roll.
Maps.
Colleagues, I'm glad to vote in favor of this ordinance. By voting in favor of this ordinance, we will reduce the amount of time Portlanders spend waiting on hold when they call 911. That time savings will save lives, and there is more good news. This pilot project will not bring any new cost to the city of Portland. Instead, BOIC will pay for this pilot project from its own budget. For these reasons and more, I vote aye.
Ryan.
Thank you, Commissioner Mapps, and also thank you, Director Kazi. I was able to spend some valuable time out at your operations on last Friday, and it was very eye-opening. I especially enjoyed the sit-along. Is that what it's called? Yeah.
Yep.
And I really want to also thank the employees that I met there. They're under heavy pressure. You could say a lot of public pressure, and what I experienced was people with a very good attitude and very competent at their work. And at least when I was there, the calls were being picked up rather quickly. And just the coordination was really amazing. So I think this is the right investment at the right time. We're digging out of a hole. I know that we had a year where we made some decisions that allowed us to do what we thought was right in terms of what we were experiencing at the beginning of the pandemic. And yet, not having those trainings for about a year really has put us in a deficit. So I think that we need creative investments to get us back to a level playing field. So I appreciate you and all of you at BOIC, and I vote aye.
Hardesty.
I want to begin by saying how much I appreciate and respect our 911 dispatchers. You have a very difficult job during normal times, but we certainly are not living in normal times today. Thank you for all you've done to help Portland respond to the crises we continue to face as a city. I would love to find a way to reward all our essential workers who have never had the options of working from home,
but instead we're on the front line of Portland's pandemic response, and that includes our 911 dispatchers. However, I continue to be concerned with double overtime proposals coming separately from three different bureaus overseen by three different commissioners across our first responder systems. The reason I have been concerned is that these are not budget decisions that should be made as one-offs, but instead together as part of a citywide vision. Already our budget office is warning that we could be looking at cuts during the next annual budget cycle. We cannot guarantee these overtime costs can be recovered in the upcoming budget. That means providing double overtime today could lead to cutting jobs in the future if the city does not display good financial stewardship. So as much as I love and appreciate all the hardworking 911 dispatchers and the critical work they perform, I will be voting no today. I vote no.
Wheeler.
Ensuring the safety of our community is a core tenet of our responsibility as elected officials. As we work to meet that duty, we have to be resourceful with the limited means that we have at our disposal. I appreciate the resourcefulness evident here and the efforts to find solutions against a backdrop of compulsory overtime and demanding work. And I want to underscore that point. This is not voluntary overtime. This is mandated overtime after serving an already very long shift. Under this unique circumstances present here, the pilot is an option that we must explore. And again, it's a pilot. So this temporary approach may not be the ultimate solution, but I do believe it's a viable stopgap while training and restaffing work is underway. With that, I vote aye, and the ordinance is adopted. Next item, please, 832.
Amend operating agreement with Rip City Management LLC for Veterans Memorial Coliseum to extend term to October 11th, 2025.
And with that, I will turn it over to... You're right, thank you, Commissioner. Second reading. Any further business on this item? Call the roll.
Maps.
Aye.
Ryan.
We're thrown off with the new order, or I am. Anyway, thank you, Mayor Wheeler, and thank you, Lloyd Rose. Basically, thank you, Rip City Management, for your presentation last week. This is very important to move forward. I also think that we have to keep looking at how this feeds into this entertainment district for the long term. So this is just a minor vote and a much bigger topic as we incorporate the entertainment district in with the Alpina vision. And I'm excited that we're having these conversations on the dais, and we always want to make sure that we make the right decision at the right time. So this is an easy yes. I vote aye.
Hardesty.
Yes, I also appreciated the presentation last week. I was happy to have on the public record that Rip City Management is interested in continuing dialogue and conversation about all the massive transit improvements that will be taking place between the Rose Quarter, the I-5, and the Albina Vision Trust activities. This is just to align this contract with other contracts that are being managed so that they are all under the same timeline. This in no way changes any of the current agreements or makes any promises into the long-term future. And because of that, I am voting aye.
Wheeler.
I want to begin by thanking Chris Oxley for coming to council last week to present and extend a thank you to the city's Spectator Venues program manager, Carl Lyle, for his very hard work on this item. Sporting events continue to be a source of civic pride within our community, as well as a deeply valuable component of our city's economic DNA. Rip City Management has proven to be an excellent steward of the Moda Center and Veterans Memorial Coliseum, and of the events that take place at these sites. I want to thank you all for supporting this 8th amendment to the Coliseum operating agreement and extend my thanks to Rip City Management. I vote aye. The ordinance is adopted. Next item, please. 833.
create two new non-represented classifications of operations director and incident command manager and establish compensation ranges for these classifications.
Colleagues, this is a second reading. Any further discussion? Seeing none, please call the roll.
Mattson.
Aye.
Ryan.
Aye.
Hardesty.
No.
Wheeler.
I vote aye. The ordinance is adopted. Next item, 834.
Revised conditions required for North Baldwin Street east of North Delaware Avenue as vacated.
Second reading. Any further discussion? Seeing none, please call the roll.
Maps.
Aye.
Ryan.
Aye.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Wheeler.
Aye. The ordinance is adopted. 835. Second reading, please. Read.
Authorize application to the state of Oregon through the Higher Education Coordinating Commission for a grant in the amount of $500,000 to develop an emergency medical technician certificate program for individuals from underserved communities.
Second reading, call the roll.
Maps.
Aye.
Ryan.
Thank you, Commissioner Hardesty and Chief Boone, for moving this forward. It's definitely the feel-good item of the week for all the right reasons. I vote aye.
Hardesty.
Thank you, Chief Sarah Boone, for your innovation and creativity. I look forward to us winning this grant and actually helping to create more health providers from the Portland Bureau of Fire and Rescue. I vote aye.
Wheeler.
Aye. Ordinance is adopted. Back to the consent agenda. Item 826 was pulled.
Pay settlement of Kelly Corrado's bodily injury lawsuit in the sum of $30,000 involving Portland Parks and Recreation and the Portland Police Bureau.
This ordinance resolves a lawsuit brought against the city in July of 2019. Deputy City Attorney Caroline Turco and Senior Claims Analyst Joseph Jesse are here to present the ordinance. Who pulled this item?
Mayor was I.
Okay.
Mayor, I pulled it not for a detailed conversation, but just out of respect for the public who normally pulls anything that's a five-figure number when it relates to police settlement. So just wanted to save time.
Very good. I'll turn that over to our attorneys.
Good morning, Commissioners. Mayor Wheeler. This case arises out of an incident on July 25th, 2017. Mr. and Mrs. Corrado went to the newly opened Poets Beach Park. They went to an area just south of the park boundary and were assaulted by a houseless individual named Jonathan Rance. Mr. Rance was prosecuted by the Multnomah County DA and incarcerated. The Corrados filed their lawsuit in federal court, and then it was moved to Multnomah County Court. Mrs. Corrado asked for $3,500 in medical bills and $3,000 in lost wages and $500,000 in pain and suffering. In the attack, she suffered a head laceration that required staples, and then she went to therapy as well. The parties attended mediation with Richard Spear and agreed upon the proposed amount.
Any further discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Mayor, I have a question.
Commissioner Mapps.
Can legal counsel explain to me why this city is the one being sued here? In this situation, I'd expect the person who committed the assault to be the subject of the suit.
Yes, Your Honor, or Your Honor, I'm sorry, I've been in court.
Thank you very much. I got a promotion today.
I'm sorry. Yes, the Corrados sued the city because the city set up the park environment and there was some expectation that the city had made the area secure. We did third party Mr. Rance into the lawsuit and we had an expectation that a jury would award most of the liability for Mr. Rance. However, because Mr. Rance does not have any assets in his name, the expectation was that that liability would be reallocated to the city. So to answer your question, or if I'm answering your question correctly, Mr. Rance was not initially sued. However, the city did attempt to bring him into the suit so liability could be put on him in name. However, I believe the city would have carried the weight of the monetary liability at the end of the day.
So does this mean the city is financially liable for all assaults that take place in City Park?
This case presented some unique circumstances. Generally, the parks benefit from immunity under the recreational immunity statute. However, that statute does have an exception for reckless or intentional conduct. This case was also unique in that there was evidence that the Parks Department and PPB had some awareness of Mr. Rance's presence before the incident. So I don't think that every incident in the parks would lead to liability, but when there is some foreknowledge, some awareness of a hazard and a failure to eliminate a hazard, then liability can arise. Does that answer your question?
It did answer my question, although I might push back on your characterization that this particular incident is unique. This incident sounds awfully familiar. I feel like I've seen dozens, if not hundreds, and frankly, perhaps even thousands of versions of this incident since I've been on this council, and I think I've been on this council for 1 year and 10 months. I completely understand why the victims here are outraged. And deserved better. I'm frankly a little bit mystified by the settlement, and I think it also kind of sets an unfortunate precedent and probably most important underscores the need for a more effective public safety system. I certainly look forward to the day when Portlanders can go to their parks and enjoy those open spaces without being assaulted. I do think that that is a completely legitimate expectation. I'm not sure what happens when the city pays out every time that expectation is not met. Thank you very much.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, please call the roll. I'm sorry, I need to ask for public testimony. Is there any public testimony on this?
No one signed up.
Call the roll.
Maps.
Aye.
Ryan.
Aye.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Wheeler.
As with many of these settlements that come to the council on consent, these are negotiated settlements between parties. There's much about this one that does not sit well with me, and I want to say that on the record. Having said that, my objective here is to limit further liability to the taxpayers, because when we say the city pays, what we really mean is the taxpayers pay. And this has already become an expensive proposition for the city. So in an effort to limit further taxpayer expenditures on this item, and at the advice of my attorney, I will say no more except vote aye. The ordinance is approved and the settlement is approved. And we're adjourned for this morning.